Lecture 2, From Israelite to Jew.
Hi, my name is Shai Cherry, and we're continuing with our introduction to Judaism here at the Teaching Company. This lecture is entitled From Israelite to Jew. What we hope to do in this lecture is to outline the history of the Israelite people according to the Tanakh, according to the Hebrew Bible. I want to emphasize that the history that we're going to be talking about for the next 30 minutes is the history or the historiography, the story of the Israelites' existence and dedication to God and problems with keeping dedicated to God and their experiences in the land of Israel from their own perspective. For many of these historical events, we don't have external corroboration. So what I'm not doing here is presenting Jewish history. I'm presenting the history of the Israelite people from their own perspective. And we start at the beginning, as we talked about in Lecture 1, with the creation of the world. That was the point of the creation of human beings. The rabbis recognized early on that those first 6 days of creation really couldn't be technical days of creation, because for the first 3 days, the sun wasn't around, right? The sun wasn't created until day 4. And we generally mark the passage of a day by the sun. Whether the sun goes around us or we go around the sun is involved. So the rabbis started counting time, not from day 1, but from the existence of human beings, day 6. Therefore, there's no problem in Judaism with accepting an age of the earth as 4.5 billion years old, which is what the scientists tell us. And also, incidentally, there's also no problem accepting the transmutation of species, which is widely accepted within the Jewish community. From the creation, we go to Cain and Abel and what we call primeval myth or primeval history, the Tower of Babel, stories that try to get at this very complicated relationship between God and early human beings that seem to keep going downhill. With Cain and Abel, we have Cain killing his brother Abel. Then we've got God wiping out all of humanity in the flood of Noah. And what does God say? This very sad line from Genesis 6:5, that the devisings of a human being's heart are only evil from his youth. This psychological propensity to commit evil. Notice it's a psychological propensity to commit evil and not a kind of ontological, which is that big Greek word that means in your essence, a necessity to be evil. But certainly the characters in the early chapters in Genesis did not act very righteously. History then continues with Noah and his family, and again, things go downhill with the building of the Tower of Babel. Finally, God decides to select one person, and from that one person, to establish a covenant and to see if by having a specific covenant with a specific person, he can build a righteous society. And this, of course, is Avram. His name doesn't become Abraham until a few chapters later. God tells Abram, or Avram, to leave Aram, where he was from, and to head out toward the land of Israel because he doesn't want to be encumbered with the baggage of his parents and his high school buddies and his community. He really needs to start thinking out of the box and start worshiping God, one God, as opposed to a multiplicity of gods, in a new way that will best be done on a solo journey. Not quite solo. He takes his wife and he takes his nephew Lot, right? And they head as well as his father, Terach, and they head west toward the land of Israel, which at that point is called the land of Canaan. Maybe that happened about 2000 BCE, something like that. What is these initials BCE? Before the Common Era, as opposed to before Christ. And then after the next side of the divide is not AD, Anno Domini, the year of our Lord, because Jews don't recognize Jesus as being the Lord, so they say the Common Era. So on the one hand, they're using more, academics and Jews both tend to use this terminology of BCE, before the Common Era, and CE, the Common Era, as a way to be more neutral. On the other hand, they're still using the birth of Jesus as that which demarcates what came before and what came after. So the years that I'm going to be talking about are still the same years if you just need to convert in your head from BCE to BC or from CE to AD. So again, Abraham, the patriarchs, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, that probably happened around 2000 BCE, if it happened. Again, scholars don't have any evidence outside of the Hebrew Bible that there were such people as the patriarchs. This is Jewish history from within the biblical corpus. Then we've got the book of Exodus. It begins with, the Israelites becoming very fruitful and multiplying greatly, and there seems to be a change of regime, a new pharaoh who doesn't recognize or who doesn't like, perhaps, Joseph and his clan. And so we have this route, we have this trick, really, to kill. It's not a trick, it's a contract to kill the male babies and keep the female babies alive because there's a concern that there's going to be some kind of revolt. Eventually, the Hebrews, the Israelites, they're called Hebrews at this point, are made slaves. And Moses, around the year 1250 BCE, succeeds in letting my people go, in freeing the Israelite slaves from the house of bondage, taking them through the Sea of Reeds. The Red Sea is actually a mistranslation. It's not red, it's reed. There were reeds in those seas, Yam Suf, the Sea of Reeds. And then eventually, 49 days after the liberation from Egypt, they get to Mount Sinai and they have a revelatory experience of God giving the Decalogue. Jews say Decalogue, by the way, not the Ten Commandments, because Jews have 613 commandments. And there are actually more than 10 that are included in the Decalogue. For instance, on 6 days you shall work, on the seventh day shall be a Sabbath to you. Well, usually you count one, that you should have a Sabbath on the seventh day. But there's also, on 6 days you shall work. People forget about working for 6 days, especially in this country, but it's one of the commandments. Okay? So we say the Decalogue are the 10 utterances, the 10 words of God. There's a 40-year sojourn in the desert. And then finally, Moses dies and that whole generation dies. The only two people from that generation, from the Exodus, that actually lived to make it into the promised land, the land of Canaan at this point, are Joshua and Caleb. And Joshua ben Nun assumes leadership from Moses, and he leads the Israelites across the Jordan River, and the Jordan River splits, just like Moses split the Sea of Reeds. If we were to make a sequel to the Ten Commandments, they'd probably use the same set at Universal Studios. Brings the Israelites, or at least the vanguard stormtroopers, to Jericho, conquers Jericho, and that begins this period of conquest that probably lasts about 200 years. And finally, what we have in the 11th century BCE is a loose confederation of the 12 tribes of Israel. Jacob, whose name gets changed to Israel, has 12 sons, and not exactly each of those sons, but basically each of those sons, and then there are two tribes from Joseph, Manasseh and Ephraim, but Levi, one of the sons, doesn't get a tribal inheritance. So there are 12 tribes that get land in the land of Israel and also in what today is Jordan, just on the other side of the Jordan River. And they existed in a loose confederacy for about 200 years until around, they would mobilize and get together for external threats. But otherwise, they would conduct their own business, their own governmental affairs, their own judicial needs as a confederation, sort of the federalist system, rather than having a strong centralized government. Around the year 1020 BCE, the Israelites demanded a king. Let us have a king. And the prophet Samuel anoints Saul, Shaul, as the first king of Israel. Right? It doesn't go so well for the first 20 years. Finally, David takes over the kingship from Saul. David is not King Saul's son. David becomes the second king of Israel. And at that point, the monarchy becomes hereditary so that any legitimate king of Israel has to be able to claim Davidic ancestry, which is why the genealogies in the Gospels of the New Testament, Matthew and Luke, all trace the genealogy of Jesus, who is understood to be the Messiah or the King of Israel, back to David, right? Because that's how you claim authentic entitlement to the crown. David had many, many, many sons, and one particular son through Bathsheba, which is an interesting story all by itself. Solomon assumes the crown around 961, and his reign is marked by internal rebellion. One of the things about Solomon's reign is that he is successful in building the temple in Jerusalem. And here we have a quote from 1 Kings 8 that describes that moment of the dedication of the first temple. "Then Solomon stood before the altar of the Lord in the presence of the whole community of Israel. He spread the palms of his hands toward heaven and said, 'O Lord God of Israel, in the heavens above and on the earth below, there is no God like you, who keep your gracious covenant with your servants when they walk before you in wholehearted devotion.'" Notice that Solomon says, "There is no God like you." At this point in the Israelite religion, it's not pure monotheism. The Israelites may only have one God, but that's not to say that they don't recognize the existence of other gods for other people. They only have one God. This is either called henotheism, right? Worship of one God, or monolatry. Worship of one God, right? Two words to get at the same idea. So at this point, the Israelites only worshiped one God, at least officially. They were only supposed to worship one God. We see some backsliding periodically in the prophetic books of the Hebrew Bible. But they recognized the existence and reality of other gods for the other surrounding peoples. When King Solomon dies in 922, the kingdom of Israel splits. You've got the 10 northern tribes. That's called Israel. And you've got two tribes in the south. That's called Judah. So you've got the kingdom of Israel and the kingdom of Judah. Jerusalem is in Judah. It's actually in the tribal allotment of Benjamin. The 10 northern tribes were ruled by Jeroboam, and the southern tribes were ruled by Solomon's son, Rehoboam. Now, in 721, you've got the great power at that point of the ancient Near East, Assyria, coming in and destroying the northern kingdom. The Israelites in the north, in the northern kingdom of Israel, they're exiled at that point, and they're decimated. So one out of every 10 was killed. That's what decimated means, right? Decimal. And the other 9 were spread out all over the Assyrian kingdom, which was quite extensive at that point. Those are the 10 lost tribes of Israel. It's not that they were lost, they didn't know where they were, but they lost their national identity or their corporate identity because they weren't exiled en masse. So they assimilated and acculturated into the surrounding regions. That happened in 721 BCE. The kingdom of Judah fared a little bit better. And so they actually didn't experience the wrath of the leading power of the day until 150 years or so later. At that point, the way power politics works, the Assyrians were no longer the hegemon in the region, but the Babylonians were. And in 597, the Babylonians conquered Judah, the two southern tribes in that southern kingdom, and they exiled its leaders. And then in 586, the final blow came. The temple in Jerusalem that King Solomon had built was destroyed by the Babylonians, and the Judean population was exiled to Babylonia en masse. So they maintained their corporate identity. So they were Judeans outside of Judah. This is the first time in Jewish history where people that later become called Jews, have to deal with having this kind of identity that's linked to the land that they're no longer living on. Let me read to you one of the Psalms, Psalm 137, that gets at this feeling of being displaced and disoriented. "By the rivers of Babylon, there we sat and wept as we thought of Zion. There on the poplars we hung our lyres, for our captors asked us there for songs, our tormentors for amusement. Sing us one of the songs of Zion. How can we sing a song of the Lord on alien soil? If I forget you, O Jerusalem, let my right hand wither. Let my tongue stick to my palate if I cease to think of you. If I do not keep Jerusalem in my memory, even at my happiest hour." They were tormented by their Babylonian captors. And one of the things that the Judeans respond is, how can we sing a song of the Lord on alien soil? Perhaps what's going on here is that their understanding, even in the 6th century BCE, is that the God of Israel only works when they're in the land of Israel. And that when they're on alien soil, God either can't hear or God is not powerful. But there seems to be a suggestion anyway that we haven't yet reached, which we will in the next century, this idea of there being one God for all the world that is powerful all over the world, that can hear people's prayers all over the world, and that is the one God for all the peoples in the world. So we see stages in development of Israelite theology. Again, we have a switch in the power politics of the region. Babylon goes down and Persia comes up. The Persians, under King Cyrus II, conquer Babylon in 539, and they allow the Judeans to return to what is now called Yehud. The way to say Jew in Hebrew is Yehudi. Someone who comes from Yehud, right, from Judea, is a Judean, or in English we now say a Jew. Right? We think of Judaism as a religion, but it was certainly attached intrinsically to this geography of place in the land of Israel, Judah. The Judeans who return, which is only about 10% of the exiled population to Babylonia, they engage in the rebuilding of the temple. This now becomes the second temple, which was dedicated in 516. So 516 is when they dedicated it, 586 is when it was destroyed. There was a 70-year span when the temple didn't exist. Keep that 70 years in mind. We will come back to it 70 years after the second temple is destroyed. It's a preview of coming attractions. The next major movement in Israelite history is when Alexander the Great conquers the ancient Near East, goes very, very, very far east. Alexander the Great, he brings Hellenism. He was a student, legend has it, of Aristotle. And he brings Hellenistic culture, philosophy, literature, drama into the regions under his occupation, the empire that he has conquered. Upon his death, that kingdom of Alexander the Great was divided into three parts. And the land of Israel was controlled initially by the Ptolemies of Egypt. And the Ptolemies of Egypt, they encouraged Hellenism, but they didn't aggressively push Hellenism, so that those people living in Judea who wanted to maintain their ancestral ways, their ancestral religions, could do so without harassment, without interference. That changed in the year 200, when the land of Israel changed hands from the Ptolemies from Egypt to the Seleucids of Syria. And the Seleucids began spreading Hellenistic ideas and philosophy and religion more aggressively throughout the land of Israel. This is where the history might become a little more familiar to some of you, because around the year 168, we have the first war for religious freedom recorded in history. And that was initiated by Judah and his sons, the Maccabees, right? Otherwise known as the Hasmoneans. The name Maccabee, by the way, means hammer in Hebrew, and that might be why they got their name, because they hammered the Syrians. Or it might be an acronym for a verse that we have in Exodus chapter 15 that says, Mi kamocha be'elim Adonai. If you take the first letters of those four words, Mi kamocha be'elim, and then Adonai begins with a yud or the Y, that spells out Maccabee. And what do those four words mean? Who is like you, O Lord, amongst the gods, or amongst the mighty, is how it's traditionally translated. And that may have been what the Maccabees put on their shields as they went to war against the Syrian Greeks or the Syrian Seleucids. So we're not sure exactly what Maccabees refers to. This war that we celebrate today as the holiday of Hanukkah was certainly a war against the Hellenism of the Syrian Greeks. But you also have to remember that it was a civil war. It was a civil war between those Jews who were less Hellenized and those Jews who were more Hellenized. And the Maccabees represent tradition, the customs of the ancestors, their Right. They were Hellenized to a degree, but they didn't want to become as Hellenized as many other people in the land of Israel did, who thought, great, we can be cosmopolitan, we can be like Alexander the Great, why maintain these particularistic distinctions? Let's join the world culture of Hellenism. Let's stop engaging in traditional Jewish law. Let's stop circumcising our kids. Let's stop this allegiance to the Torah, and let's become good Hellenistic citizens. Right? That was too much for the Maccabees, and a whole group of more traditional conservative with a small c, Jews that really went to war against those more Hellenizing elements. The reign of the Hasmoneans expanded the territory of the Kingdom of Israel, but the dynasty quickly became corrupt. About 100 years later, there was struggle between two brothers within the Hasmonean dynasty, and one brother actually invited Rome, that was now the new power, right? The Greeks had been the power. Now Rome takes over as the great power. And one of the brothers invited Rome in to the land of Israel in 63 BCE. And once Rome had a toehold in the land, they slowly established control of the land. First, they had native-born rulers to represent them and to collect taxes. And finally, they appointed their own procurators in order to control the masses and collect taxes. One of the things that they're particularly interested in was the collection of taxes. At this point, things were bad for the people living in the land of Israel. Taxation was burdensome. They didn't have political freedom. They didn't have the religious freedom that they had experienced under the Hasmonean dynasty. And so apocalyptic visions of the end of time start to proliferate. And people begin suggesting, oh, maybe he's the one to fight the Romans and to kick them out of the land and to be the Messiah, right? We'll have a whole session on the Messiah, but the fundamental idea of the Messiah is the idea of a Jewish king related to King David who reestablishes Jewish political sovereignty for Jews in the land of Israel. So there began to be messianic speculation at this point, and finally, in the year 66, this tinderbox explodes, and we have what's called the Great Revolt from 66 to 70. The Great Revolt is started by Jewish zealots, sort of right-wing nationalists who believe that only Jews should be in political control of the land of Israel and of the temple. So they initiate the Great Revolt against the Romans. The occasion for the revolt was when the Roman procurator, Gessius Florus, expropriated gold from the temple treasury, which would only be used for holy things. And so this provided a pretext for the war. So although it took several years, the Great Revolt is eventually quashed, and the Second Temple is destroyed by the Romans in the year 70. According to rabbinic sources, rabbinic legend, one member who represents the accommodationist party in Judaism, the doves, the liberals, Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai, during the Great Revolt, before the temple is destroyed, he is spirited out of Jerusalem in a coffin by his disciples and is allowed by the Roman war, by the Roman general who is prosecuting the war, to establish what becomes the seed of rabbinic Judaism, an academy of rabbinic sages at Yavne. Some scholars suggest this was really a POW camp for some of the people captured. We don't really know historically what Yavne was, but what the rabbinic sources tell us is that it was the seat of rabbinic Judaism founded by Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai. What happened to these zealots, by the way? The zealots that started the Great Revolt to begin with in 66, they managed to escape the old city before it was destroyed. And Josephus, who is a historian of this period, he started out as a Jewish soldier and then surrendered to Roman forces in the north of Israel and sort of bargained his way into a nice villa and pension in Rome. And he would agree to write the history of the Jews during this period, which he did in Greek. He describes how sanguinary this revolt's end was, that blood was flowing through the streets of Israel. Blood was flowing through the streets of Jerusalem. At that point, the zealots figured out that the writing, the blood, was on the wall. They managed to escape from Jerusalem, and they went up to one of the last king of Israel's mountain fortresses at Masada. and were able to survive there until around the year 74, when the Romans finally succeeded in breaching the walls of Masada. There's a great mini-series that describes those events. The Jews on the mountain decided to commit suicide rather than to be captured and enslaved by the Romans. Okay, on one foot, as we say, that's the history of the Jews for about 2,000 years, from the patriarchs to the destruction of the Second Temple. Now what I want to do is outline what some of the Jewish sects were at the eve of the destruction of the Temple. One group that we know about from the New Testament and from Josephus, as well as from rabbinic literature, are the Sadducees. The Sadducees didn't have an oral tradition that interpreted the Torah that we have, the Pentateuch. Therefore, they denied resurrection of the dead because resurrection isn't mentioned at all in the Torah, in the Pentateuch. We have references to resurrection in later books, but because it doesn't appear in the Torah, the Sadducees rejected it. They also denied divine omniscience, since free will is a necessary assumption of the Torah. God lays out all kinds of laws and commands and says, choose life, choose to follow the commandments. That didn't make sense to the Sadducees if God knew ahead of time what the Jews were going to decide to do. The Sadducees were also connected with the aristocracy and the priesthood. They tended to be the more Hellenized members of society. Another group in Second Temple Judaism were called the Essenes, and the Essenes are widely associated with a group living around the Dead Sea and are held to be responsible for the Dead Sea Scrolls, which were found in 1947 by a little Bedouin boy. The Essenes were an ascetic community with an apocalyptic theology that was also dualistic. So they understood the world was coming to an end, and how would that world come to an end? The sons of light and the sons of darkness would battle each other, with the sons of light prevailing. The Essenes reject free will totally and claim that divine providence controls everything. Another group were followers, early followers of Jesus. Outside the land of Israel, they're called Christians. Inside the land of Israel, they're called Nazarenes, because Jesus lived for the majority of his life in Nazareth. They claimed that Jesus was the Messiah, although Jewish sovereignty had not yet been restored to Israel. Thus, there was the prophecy of an imminent second coming in order to fulfill those earlier expectations of what a Messiah would do. Outside the land of Israel, we have St. Paul, who is known as the Apostle to the Gentiles, and he spreads the good news, the gospel, throughout the Roman Empire and was incredibly successful in doing so. The last group that really had the most Israelites at that time affectionate toward were the Pharisees. The Pharisees have gotten a terrible reputation, a tragic reputation, from the New Testament. But the Pharisees were the most popular group amongst all these groups before the temple was destroyed in the year 70. They claimed an oral tradition which interpreted the Torah. So unlike the Sadducees, the Pharisees believed in resurrection, and they also believed in the world to come, that people would get rewarded or punished in the next world upon death, depending on what their actions were in this world. The Pharisees promoted the priestly purity laws that were only obligatory for the priests as a way for all of Israel to attain holiness. They really were interested in democratizing Judaism, in taking the temple Judaism that's described in the Bible and making it accessible and obligatory for all of Israel. The Pharisees can be viewed as the spiritual descendants of the spiritual ancestors of the rabbis. Whenever the rabbis talk about a dispute between the Pharisees and the Sadducees, without exception, they always agree with the Pharisees. The oral tradition of the Pharisees becomes the oral Torah of the rabbis, so that by the time we get to our next lecture that talks about the value, the preeminent value of Talmud Torah, it's actually in two lectures, the oral traditions have become an oral Torah that have the same authority and the same origin as the written Torah. So that according to the rabbis, at Mount Sinai, God gave to Moses not just the written Torah that we have in the Pentateuch, but also the oral Torah that includes all of the interpretations for those parts of the Torah that aren't so clear or weren't included in any case. So we'll talk about more about the oral Torah in the future. When the destruction happens in the year 70, we see that two of those four groups lose their existence. The Sadducees had been associated with the temple, and so once the temple is destroyed, they lose their institutional power base. And the Essenes were wiped out. They were physically killed during the Great Revolt. So the only two groups left from Second Temple Judaism were the Nazarenes / Christians, and it took a couple of hundred years, but the Jewish Christians, who still maintained fidelity to Jewish law and thought that Jesus was the Messiah, they eventually sort of fell by the wayside. But Gentile Christianity, that no longer felt obligated to the commandments, that was an incredible success story for Christianity. And then the Pharisees, morphing into rabbinic Judaism, then become the one kind of Judaism for hundreds of years that dominates the Jewish world, and they achieve hegemony within the Jewish world. Now, the next lecture that we're going to look at focuses on what the central religious concept of these rabbinic Jews was in the post-temple reality. Thank you.